evening and welcome to The Librarian on Authors on the Air. I am the librarian host, Tabitha Pope. This is a copyrighted and trademarked podcast owned solely by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC, on the web at our new website, authorsontheair.com. Tonight I have historical romance author, Kate Robbins. Best-selling author of the award-winning Highland Chief series, Kate Robbins writes historical romance out of pure escapism and a love for all things Scottish. She thoroughly enjoys the research process and delving into secondary sources in order to blend authentic historical fact into her stories. Ranging 600 years, Kate's novels are filled with passion, adventure, and political intrigue. Kate is a pen name of Debbie Robbins, who lives in St. John's, Newfoundland, and Labrador, Canada. You can find out more about Kate and her books right here at this link, which is on her publisher's website. And you can also follow her on Facebook and Twitter, and we'll give you all those links here in a little bit, and I'll bring her live on the show. And thanks for being on, Kate.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We are almost as far away as you can be and still be on the North American continent, but welcome to the show.
Yes, we were just talking about that off the air. You're in Texas and I'm in Newfoundland and Labrador, Canada, which is on the far east coast. Uh-huh. Newfoundland is the island portion of the province, and we're pretty far as east as you can go in North America.
Yeah, and you catch all the remnants of the nasty storms that scoot up the coast then, huh?
We do, yes. We have, I was telling you earlier, we have sometimes four seasons in one day. That's not uncommon here. We've had entire months of fog. It's always a fun topic of conversation when you bump into a Newfoundlander to ask them how the weather is. It's very true.
Always something to talk about there. That's right.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, tell me, I meant to ask you before, how do you pronounce the name of your publisher?
Teargar.
Teargar, okay.
Teargar, yes, Teargar Publishing. And they're actually in Ireland.
Oh, okay, Teargar. Well, yes. I received an email from the publicist there, and we've had a lot of great authors, hook up for the shows, and it's been good, but I've never asked how to say it. So thank you.
Well, actually, it's interesting because one of the first things people often ask me when they hear me, I suppose when they know, is how to pronounce Newfoundland. Because if you look at the word itself, a lot of people will say Newfoundland or Newfoundland,
right,
or whatever, but we just say Newfoundland, and we say that typically it rhymes with understand.
Yeah.
And so if you, right, Newfoundland, understand, and that's pretty much how we say that for here. But, so yes, it's Teargar is, Kimberly would be the better one to explain where it comes from, but it looks very different than it sounds.
Yeah, it does, and I want to look at it going, I'm going to screw that up. I'm just going to ask. Okay, So that's what the link that I put on this page was your link to your profile on their website so that people could check out all your books. I'm sure they can find you on your Amazon page as well. But
yes, for sure.
So historical fiction is your addiction,
mm-hmm,
writing addiction. And
yes.
We talked just a second before the show about, I told you that historical is definitely my favorite thing to read. I'm just finishing Dragonfly and Amber because I refused to watch the second season until I finished it.
Absolutely.
I was like, nope. I watched the first one. I was like, oh, damn it. I got to turn it off. There's no way I'm watching this. So I am almost free to watch it, and I'm really excited. I'm just very deep into it. So what is your, well, obviously research is a big thing for you. You must love the research. You talked about
Absolutely.
Your secondary sources.
Yes. I think that anyone who does any kind of writing will have a certain level of research. If you set a novel in a different city, you need to understand the logistics of getting around in that city. Or, if you're writing about a paramedic, you need to understand the things that a paramedic does in order for your character to be able to be convincing to the reader. But with historicals, there's a whole other layer to that because you take for granted sometimes – when you're writing that you can use certain words mm-hmm. that are words that we would use every day. However, with historicals, there is an expectation, and rightly so, that you would make word choices that would be true to the time. So it's not just a matter of describing a setting, a location, describing clothing and, you know, mannerisms and things like that that would make it convincing to be, in my case, in the 15th century in Scotland. But also word choice is huge, and I've become a bit of a geek when it comes to word choice. I love checking on etymology.com, and I admit I miss them. There are times when readers say, "Oh, this word wasn't used back then." I'm like, "Oh gosh, I missed that one." Okay, but a lot of times I will check to see if I had this one particular portion of a story where the perfect word was vendetta, but vendetta is an Italian word. And mm-hmm. I believe it was first used in the 18th century. So I simply couldn't use it convincingly in a 15th century Scottish story. So I had to find something else that would describe what that was for my characters in that setting. So, yeah, research isn't simply about knowing the location, knowing the geography. It's also knowing as much as you can possibly learn about the story, about the location and the setting, but also then about the time period and the history. And in my case as well, I really like bringing in the political side of it.
Right.
When I first started writing my first novel, Bound to the Highlander, I sort of knew it was medieval, but I wasn't really sure exactly when. So I started looking at the different political leaders at the time in Scotland, and I came across James Stewart I, and as soon as I started reading about him, I was hooked. And this entire series, you know, each story can stand alone, but the entire series has a thread all the way through it about James Stewart I. And mm-hmm. the series will most likely end with a book about him and his wife. So I'm a bit of a geek for the history, and it definitely sparks the story for me.
Yeah, and that's when you have that kind of passion about, you know, when you get into something and you just like really get into it and geek out over it.
Yep.
You know, that comes across really well in writing, to the reader, and then we get our chance to geek out too. So that's all.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, I'm the more I visit Scotland and the more I read about the history, the more I just have so many stories, and there just isn't enough time in the day to get them all out. I have at least two more series that are unrelated to Highland Chiefs that I plan to write that I've already started doing research for. And, I mean, that would keep me going for quite some time, because what happens is when I'm writing the first book, these other secondary characters just happen across the page.
Right.
And then you're thinking, oh, wow, well, this character is interesting. And by the time the story's over, you're not ready to give that character away. You know, you can't give them up. So the next thing you know, you're writing a story about this one, and then
right.
another character comes along, and it just keeps going and going. And, you know, I try not to lock myself down too much. I'm not a plotter at all. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely a pantser, so I like to just sort of free flow write in the beginning, and sort of edit as much as I can through the second draft. But it's absolutely amazing to me how, for my process anyway, when I just let it go, the things that happen surprise even me, which I know some people might find that hard to believe. I mean, people have said, "How can you be surprised you're writing it?" But I sort of am, because it's almost like my reader and my writer are two separate entities at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the reader is going, "Wow, I can't believe this one just did that." I'm like, "I didn't know it was going to happen either." So it sounds, this is why writers can be, you know, considered a little bit crazy sometimes, because we're caught in our heads with all these characters roaming around all the time. And, you know, they're very real to us. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, no, I've heard that that multiple personality disorder is a requirement for an author.
I absolutely
believe
that.
We love it.
I absolutely believe that. I mean, if you're so, you know, when you're writing in the third person and you're deep, deep, deep into a character's point of view, I mean, you're thinking as that character at that time. So you have to, you know, the only thing that I could liken it to would be an actor preparing for a role.
Right.
You are getting inside that character's head before you put your fingers on the keyboard or put your pen in your hand or whatever your process is, in order to be able to understand what their motivations are going to be. What are they going to say in this certain circumstance, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I totally understand. I totally understand. And, you know, it's funny because as a reader, if you've never actually sat down and tried to write something and get into somebody else's point of view like that, you know, you do the opposite. Not really the opposite. It's similar, but you get so wrapped up in the story
right.
yourself that you're thinking as a character while you're reading it, you know.
And you should be, right.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, you feel all those emotional responses that the character is having to the situations too, which is exactly what as a writer you want to happen. So
exactly. When it's done well, and I mean, you know, I will always strive to do better with every book that I write. And I think that's the great part about writing is there's always something new to learn. There's always a skill to fine tune. There's always something else. There's always some way that you can improve, which so it never gets boring.
Mm-hmm.
But with point of view writing, I think it's one of the biggest challenges that I've found. You know, I love writing dialogue. I've never really had much of an issue with dialogue. I enjoy writing setting, but getting so far into a point of view where there is no what we call author intrusion, that's really difficult to do, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of practice and a really good editor. In my case, good critique partners as well as a good editor, because once you've got somebody who can look at your writing and say, ah, author intrusion in there, you're like, oh my God, not again. Still, right, after all this time. The further you get into a character's point of view, your reader will know, because your reader will be so invested in your story. They will be as invested in your story as you are, and that's exactly what you want.
Yeah, no, that is exactly what you want. And I agree, though. I think that I think it comes across, I can't speak, comes across because of the way that you got to the story, the way that you came to the story, or the way the story came to you, I guess is more likely, you know, and I think it comes across that way. So, I think historical just does some magic on people too, because we start to dig into our collective subconscious of, you mm-hmm. know, what, the world history that whatever we know about, and it makes people interested in finding out more. I mean, I know that the first time I read a good friend of mine, who's also a Canadian author, Marissa Campbell, she wrote Avalon, which is done in the medieval time. You know,
yes.
I just got so interested in that time period. I just started looking up stuff like, oh, this is real. Oh my God. Yeah. You know?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what I try to do with mine. You know, set during the 15th century, during the reign of James Stuart I, what you will see is, I've put words in his mouth, but for mm-hmm. example, you know, he was married to Joan Beaufort. And mm-hmm. in the first book, she really was pregnant with twins that summer. And so those little nuggets are they make me happy knowing that I've written that inaccurately.
Right.
But the heroes in each of the books, so each book in the series is about a different Highland chief. And so because of the king's laws on authoritative reform, he had staunch supporters. He also had bitter enemies. So, mm-hmm. I mean, and eventually this king was assassinated. So I've taken each book is about a Highland chief, and it's his love story. But laced in through there, it was whether or not he was a supporter of the king and how that played out in his role as chief or whatever his other role. In the first book, James McIntosh is a baron. So it's all about trying to, I guess, draw all of it together. So the further into the series you get, for me, writing it, I almost need a separate person who's going to be my continuity person.
Right.
To be able to say, oh, but wait, now, 3 books ago, you said this. You can't say, I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe that. So even
so
though
that was the next thing I was going to ask you. Like, how do you keep up with all that?
Because I don't, again, there are authors who are way more organized than I am and have good records of those kinds of things, but I like to try to keep it all in my head, which is not really the smartest way to do it because I'll forget. So I just, like I said, I really don't like to be locked down with anything. So given the freedom to be able to just continue on with it, sometimes I struggle with what's come before, and I have to go back. I'm like, I know that was in book two, but I cannot remember if it was in the first part, in the middle part, or the last part, and then I find myself rereading a fair bit. But then the same thing happens. I can easily get hung up on wanting a specific piece of history to be accurate, or at the very least, know what it was, and so therefore, if I have to change it, there's a good reason for me to change it. And so I find myself sometimes I'll go looking for one small piece of history. 3 hours later, I realize, what was I even looking for in the beginning? Because I get so wrapped up in reading all of this fascinating political history and, you know, how the Stuarts shaped Scotland. The fact that they had this dynasty, and I mean, it could have fallen apart at any time, and just the things that occurred to allow this family to continue as monarchs in Scotland was just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's one of the, to me, it's one of the most fascinating dynasties in Europe, because you know, while they were separate, then they weren't, you know, and then there was this whole, even and then you go back, yours is going back to even before that, to tell how it all is all set up by itself. And that's just it is fascinating. And it's sad how it, you know, fell through, because they really did have a completely different society going on up there. I mean, to have blended in with England so quickly was really sad. But I know there's still pockets that hold on to their ways.
I think you'll find that anywhere. There's a need for a region to be independent, and then there's a period of time where it makes sense for a region to merge with another region. I mean, that's just the history of the world, and
yeah, that's how we phone type this.
those borders are always changing, and they've always changed. But for James Stuart I, he was imprisoned in England for 18 years. And while there, he was educated. He was, you know, pretty much given, he was perhaps under house arrest at best. But he, you know, he was married there. So he finally went back to the Scottish Parliament, negotiated the terms of his release. And so he was finally allowed to go back to Scotland with his English wife, with his English education. And so therefore, when he then decided, okay, I'm king and this is how it's going to be, he was met with a lot of opposition. And the fact that he actually made it through several years before he was assassinated is absolutely fascinating. But he did some amazing things.
And they pretty much helped him get it started, because they educated him. They got a wife,
you know. It depends on which side you're looking at. It depends on, but that's what I'm trying to address in the series. It's all about perspective, because the hero in the first book is a Stuart supporter, and he makes his case as to why he's a Stuart supporter. Now, the heroine in the first book is not. One of the terms of James Stuart's release was that the Scottish Crown would have to pay 40,000 marks to the English Crown, or Scottish Parliament, 40,000 marks to the English crown, but as surety for the ransom, 20 Scottish nobles had to go and live in England at their own expense until the ransom was paid. So James Stewart gets back to Scotland. He's like, I'm not paying these guys anything. So those 20 Scottish nobles were never able to return.
Oh, wow.
And so what I did in the story was the heroine in the book, one of the Scottish nobles was her father, and he never returned. And he subsequently died there. So that's where the conflict, I guess, begins between them. The inherent conflict begins between them.
Yes.
But it continues on from there. And then in the second book, the hero is actually a villain in the first book, sort of introduced as a villain in the first book. But he then obviously has his own motivations as to why he acts the way he does and the things that he's done, and so then it's another perspective. So mm-hmm. by the end of it, whether you are a Stewart supporter or not depends on which perspective you prefer.
Right. Yes. No, I agree.
So that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to give all angles as to what was sort of happening at the time.
It's funny because as you're talking about this, I'm thinking back through this book, Dragonfly and Amber, and even mm-hmm. what, like 300 years later, they were still toying with the same things, the same
Absolutely.
Political things with the same family, the same chieftain, same family. Yeah,
Absolutely.
We supported you before our clan, but what you got, what's in it for us this time? And, then they go to the other side. Well, what's in it for us? And it's just crazy, but
it's a territorial thing. It's very territorial. And I think that, the Outlander series does that exceptionally well. She really digs deep into the politics, and I love that. That's a love story is great. I love it. It is clearly what I enjoy writing, but equally as much, I love a really solid story behind it as well. I love to have a solid history.
Mm-hmm.
Historical aspect to it as well, and whether or not it's as politically charged as mine tend to be, is up to the writer. But
right.
that's the ones I've always preferred. All of that is it's just fascinating. It's just fascinating.
It is fascinating. I remember the first Philippa Gregory book that I read,
mm-hmm.
And I was still a librarian then, so I spent a lot of time at the reference desk just Googling different things about that period in history because it was just so fascinating to me. I was like, did people really do this to each other? Yes.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
If an author can get you to think about the time period in which they write, and so much so that you're interested enough to go and look it up and read some more, I think that the author has definitely done their job.
Right.
Because that's what we want you to do. We want our stories to stay with you. We want you to think about these characters long after you've reached the end.
Yes.
And
yes.
that's not always easy to do. And, every reader has a different preference. I know I do. I've read everything under the sun. And in terms of romance, I'm still probably Joanna Lindsay's biggest fan. I absolutely love. I read so many Joanna Lindsay novels, and Jude Devereaux and Julie Garwood.
Right.
Those are absolute must-haves in my romance collection. But since I've become published, I've met dozens and dozens and dozens of authors. In this genre as well, and just the quality of work that's being put out there right now is absolutely mind-boggling. It's amazing. I can't get over that after all this time, the romance genre has just continued to grow, and it continues to get better and better all the time. The quality of novels out there are just absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I do, and I'm really happy that historical has seemed to, for every now and then there's like a wave and a wave and a wave. And,
yes.
Diana Gabaldon, she had that wave back in the 90s, and everything.
Yes.
But, you know, every now and then there's a wave. But I'm glad that it's picked up again, because now we're getting all these, like you, fresher authors.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, like you said, the Lace and the Grace are awesome. Yes, absolutely must to have. But, you know, getting a fresh new perspective where somebody else is passionate about it and it comes across is
absolutely
so much fun. Yeah,
and I think first and foremost, most of the authors, the romance authors I've met, are romance reader fans as well. We're all fangirls of each other for the most part. We're all going, oh my God, I can't believe it's such and such. And, you know, we all kind of gush over one another because we can't believe we're in each other's company. And it comes from a place of deep respect, because we know how hard it is to do what we do. And
right.
I'm not sure why this has happened, but in my experience, the generosity that I've experienced with other romance authors is unbelievable. I don't know if this happens in other genres, but it certainly happens in romance. Authors are so generous with their time, with their advice. It's phenomenal. I've not experienced anything negative when reaching out to an author, or even having authors reach out to me. It's just been wonderful. It's been a phenomenal experience for me.
I have a theory about that, actually.
Okay.
I have a theory about romance authors and readers, because it's a silly theory, but I tell this all the time on the show. It's all scientific, actually. It has to do with the subject matter and the fact that when you read romance, you know, you produce endorphins. And,
mm-hmm.
and who's the happiest people in the world? The people who get a happy ending, they get to be emotional, they get to cry, produce endorphins, and then they treat each other kind because they're learning empathy through the story. So I think
that's kind of cool. I like that.
I think if they did some kind of study on endorphins and romance readers and writers, that they would understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's just no room for anything else but happy and love and helping and everything else.
That is the number one requirement, is a happily ever after.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, who doesn't like a happy ending? I mean, I've read lots of books where that wasn't really the point of the story, the happy ending, whether it happened or not. And that's all well and good. But like I said, I like to read a variety. But when I just want, you know, when I want a nice escape, or, I look for romance. I want that escape. I want to know I've had a rotten day. I want to know I'm going to have a happy ending.
Right. That's exactly right. And I'll tell you what, for mamas like me, whose time is precious with reading, you know,
mm-hmm.
I have to squeeze it in, and, you know, I'm up till 1:30 just so I can get those couple chapters in that I haven't had
absolutely.
A chance to do all day. I want it. Yes, I'm definitely going to be moving towards a happy ending, or, you know, if I have a Gone Girl type of book at the end,
yes,
and I'm pissed off about how it ends.
Yeah,
that's when no.
Love
not
that
doing
book,
this.
By the way. It was a fantastic book. In the meantime,
it was a wonderful book. You know, and as far as what a great concept. I mean, you know, you end it that way. You've got everybody in the world talking about it. So you know.
talk about fresh perspective. Talk about fresh writing. I mean, that was
extremely
well done.
I wanted to throw my Kindle at the wall, and, you know, I walked around for several days just grumpy and pissed off. And it was one of those things.
You know something? I think the best book, non-romance, that I've read in the last 5 years is All the Light We Cannot See. Have you read that one?
No, I have
Anthony
not read
Dewar?
That one, but everybody said that one.
Oh, my gosh. Make it the next book that you read. It is – it blew my mind. It's one of those books I had to slow down how quickly I was reading, because I did not want this book to end. It broke my heart when I got to the end. I couldn't believe how masterfully it was written. It was like the only thing I can say about it, it's like reading a painting, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, no, it
was
so
beautiful. It was just incredible. Blew my mind. Absolutely loved it. Highly recommend it.
Okay, well, there you go. I was going to ask you next what books that you've read recently that you really liked. So that's a good one.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I've read it. This book is set in World War II and or set during World War II. And while I've read lots of books during that time frame, there's just something special about this particular book and the way the author, the way the author creates this character of this this blind French girl, and how he describes her perceptions of what's going on around her is just, I can't even hardly talk about it. It's just so so amazing. I mean, I'm a writer. I can't even really put it into words how incredible this book really is. It's just, yeah, definitely, I highly recommend it. I mean, it'll tug on, you know, tug on your heartstrings. It's World War II, after all.
Right, yes.
It's difficult subject matter, of course. But, by far, absolutely amazing.
Well, and I think it's really brave when authors wish to approach the difficult subject matter and then are able to do it so masterfully, because, you know, it's just we always tiptoe around in real life. So when somebody really takes it to heart and dives in like that, that, you know, it does touch you deeper, I think.
Yes. Absolutely. I definitely think so. And I think that, you know, you're seeing maybe the resurgence of the historical romance in the last few years is just a sign of just this series of smarter romances that are coming out. I mean, you've got all of these great contemporary authors out there that are putting out these great witty novels, and in all genres, in paranormal, in you know, science fiction, and in historical. It's just absolutely, it's exciting. I think it's an exciting time to be a romance author, and I think the digital market has changed the game so much, and social media has changed everything so much, because I've had readers who have literally finished a book of mine, taken the time to message me on social media, and I happened to be on there at that time, so they've interacted with me, then they've turned around and picked up the second book. I mean, when, besides, you know, the last 5 years, have you been able to do that? Like, that's just, I can't even imagine being able to do that.
Yeah, the chances
of
you running into an author were rare, you know.
Pretty much never going to happen. I'm a huge Stephen King fan, and the thought of being able to finish one of his books and then message him and him saying, "Hey, thanks," and then going to pick up another one of his, that's not even sensible, right? I mean, that's really what I'm talking about. You know, anyone can pretty much get in contact with anyone now. And
that's
it's just,
so cool.
It is, I think it's fantastic, because even when I've received critical reviews, for the most part, there's been something of value to take from that. I mean, one of the funniest reviews I ever got was a 1 or 2 star review. The woman didn't like the book, but she gave a great explanation as to why. And I laughed my way all through the entire review, and I thought it was great. I'm like, you know what, man, fair enough, because there's lots of books I've read that I did not like. But the way you put me, I'm thinking to myself, maybe she should be a writer, because she has a real good, you know, real good way of explaining herself, right?
Yep.
But it's great, and I think that, you know, there's the opportunity to for I suppose authors to, if they choose to, because not everyone wants to, but if they choose to, absolutely learn from what the readers are telling them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've found that, you know, the readers that I've encountered and that I've engaged with and interacted with have just been, I mean, because I've been there. I've been a gushing fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a fan with something to say about what I liked and what I didn't like. And the fact that a lot of authors are receptive to that in this genre, I guess, and in other genres too, I suppose. I see it more in romance, so I don't know if it's quite the same, if this phenomenon is quite the same in, science fiction, I suppose, or mystery, or, you know, horror.
I don't know. I have no idea if they do or not.
I have no idea. But
I think, like we were saying, though, I think that romance readers look for the escape, and then they get it, and that makes them feel better, and then they like to tell the creator, hey, that helped me get through a really hard week, or that helped me get through a bad breakup, or that was so fascinating, it made me forget all about my troubles, or whatever.
And,
so,
and that is that's an incredible thing to hear, because you're responsible for that then, and that's just a little overwhelming, to be perfectly honest. I mean, in a good way or a bad way, it's a little overwhelming, because a lot of us, we are, again, we're the crazy ones talking to ourselves in a different character voice. I mean, we're the ones walking around with these characters in our heads, and the character that screams the loudest gets the most page time. And
like
totally true. Squeaky wheel gets the grease. Okay, fine. I'll write it that way, for God's sake. And so
nothing you can do.
Right? But so then sometimes I said this a lot in the beginning, people would come up to me and say, "Oh my gosh, I couldn't believe when this character did this. Oh, he's so bad," and I'm looking at him for a second and it takes me a beat to go, "How do you know? Oh, right, I published that." Because you're still stuck in your head. Because the times in between publishing and promoting, we're writing, we're creating, we're thinking, we're on to the next story, and sometimes you just forget. That. Anyway, maybe I shouldn't have told, maybe I shouldn't have revealed that.
But you thinking, you know, for a moment, like a mind reader. No.
I know it's but it's good when you can reach a reader at that level. That's exciting. Humbling is exactly what it is.
Well, yeah, but really, that really is the magic that comes from writing. It's the magic because if words can make somebody else elicit, you know, if it can make another person by reading those words elicit that emotion that you want your characters to, you know, show on the page, then that's magic. That's just magic. There's nothing else in the world like that. A movie shows
it to
you.
And it's an incredible thing.
You know?
It's an incredible thing for us as creators as well, because, you know, we, I don't think about, okay, I'm going to write a story about this type of character. Well, I don't know what the character is going to be like until I start writing about her.
Right,
and
exactly.
And she'll kind of, I mean, this might sound weird, but she'll tell me. Like, that'll sort of emerge as the story continues. Like, the way it works for me is I'll find a piece of history that sparks my interest, like James Stewart first, and then I'll think about, oh, okay, well, so if I, what about, I wonder if I took a Stewart supporter, which, okay, so McIntosh were Stewart supporters. Now who could be his heroine? This might be fun. I'll take this character, and she doesn't like the Stuart. And that's really how Bound to the Highlander started. And the scene just started coming out, and the characters just emerged from there. I didn't know really where it was going to go or how it was going to work out, or I didn't really have any preconceived idea as to how it would. And I guess I knew I wanted them to get together, but I had no idea how they were going to get there until they got there.
Yeah.
And then other characters emerged, and I'm like, oh, God, now what's going to happen? I guess I better keep on writing so I could find out. But
and your fans
like
probably tell
because...
you, too, that, you know, your side characters, your secondary characters are interesting, and they want to know more about them, too. So
yeah, and
when you come
and,
up
and
with
I
that,
have...
that's great.
I've had people come up to me and say, you know, so when is such and such going to get their own story? And, you know, and I've done that. I've done that for one couple so far in the series. There's another couple that I want to write about, and there's another secondary male character now in the fourth book that's coming out on November 9th that, my beta readers have told me that they think he needs to have his own story. So I could be writing this. I don't know if I'm ever getting to those other two series because there's still lots of characters in here to write about. And then, you know, there's book four comes out, Prisoner of the Highlander comes out in November 9th. And then there's another, there's definitely a book five in this series, and there's definitely a story. I'm not sure where it's going to kind of fit with the king and his and mm-hmm. his wife. So there's definitely their love story in there somewhere. It may be a prequel. It may be the book six that finishes everything. I'm not entirely sure yet. But I guess they'll tell me, they being the characters, as I'm writing it. I don't know what they got planned for me. I'm just
yeah, right. Sneak up on you. I mean, if it's a phone number out, if anybody wants to call in, mm-hmm. Kate is going to be giving away some books, some e-books. So give us a call, 347-633-9609. So tell us a little bit about the book that comes out on the 9th.
The book that comes out on the 9th is the fourth book in the series. One of the biggest, most bitter enemies of the Stuart was, of course, the MacDonalds, Lords of the Isles. And they were considered kings in their own right. And Stuart wanted their lands, of course. And so they're sort of introduced right in the beginning of the story, the MacDonalds. And so I took not the older MacDonald, but I took the son, because, of course, the older MacDonald, Alexander MacDonald, is imprisoned by the king, and the son is trying to free him and trying to find a way to free him. So the story opens with him and his clansmen. They've found a way to penetrate the castle walls.
Ooh.
And they happen. I know, I love that word, hey? It is romance, after all.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
and they happen across the queen, who's heavily pregnant, and her cousin, and who were doing a tour. The cousin is visiting from England, of course, because the queen's from England, and they're doing a tour, but, you know, some trouble broke out, and they had been at St. Margaret's Chapel at Edinburgh Castle. And so they were told to stay inside and, you know, make no noise. And anyway, so through the jigs and the reels, the hero and the heroine meet in that way. And there's a little bit of deception. And eventually he kidnaps her and she becomes his prisoner. And the rest plays out over time. Yeah. And so they travel across Scotland to Elah and Finlaggan Castle, which would have been the castle that the MacDonalds would have held power in at the time. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of traveling. They go, you know, they go over to Elah, and then so much of it happens at Edinburgh Castle. And, you know, all the books actually have more than one location in them. And I've been very fortunate because, except for, I haven't been to Elah yet, but I've visited everywhere that I've written about so far in this series, I've visited. And it's just fascinating to me when I've written a story and I've, you know, gone in on Google Earth and I've actually done the little, you know, the street view thing, and I've seen how things, you know, how things look and the landscape and all of that. But then you actually get to be there in person and smell the air. It's just it adds such a layer. Well, it adds such a layer to, you know, the first time I went there, Chatham Castle in the first book is loosely based on Aileen Donan Castle over in the Western Highlands. And if you go on their website, they have a virtual tour of the castle. And so I picked one of the chambers to be my heroine, Aileana's chamber. And when I actually got to stand in that chamber in real life, I could barely speak. I had shivers. I couldn't believe it, because in my head, I could almost see my characters moving through this particular room. And it's just amazing that this little craft that I'm doing here, this just little, you know, this little thing that I do, this thing I enjoy doing, has given me those experiences that I wouldn't have otherwise had. So it's you know,
pretty
cool.
That's really cool. And
but, so,
you
yes.
know, very authentic.
Well, it makes it more authentic because I was able to visit there. I'd written the book and I'd done all this research, and then I was able to visit there long before and add layers to the story from my visits before the book was published. So I was able to bring all of that into it. And same thing with book two. And with book three, I had visited the locations there on the first and second trip overseas. So the only one I haven't now with Prisoner of the Highlander, book four, the only part of it that I haven't been to is Ela, but I did an incredible amount of research there. And, I mean, it's crazy. I get topography maps and everything out. I'm looking at everything. And, you know, measuring distances and how would they have sailed and, you know, what exactly would have been the seating capacity on one of these Berlins and just all of this kind of stuff that you get to do. But it's very cool because you get to investigate or research and then share with other people what life might have been like at that time.
Yes. And then they get to dive in head first and, you know, live it too. So, you know, it's like I said, it's just magical. It's so fantastic. And I think historical, I don't know, there's just, to me, there's something about it. I know a lot of people, fantasy is the same way for them, you know, that diving into this whole other world. But maybe it's because of my research, but, you know, being a librarian and research is so much fun. Maybe, I don't
Absolutely.
Know, but I'm a history person too. But I just think it's so magical. The historical authors for bringing it alive. It's so great.
And it's up to, you know, very different authors will bring a different level of historical authenticity to their work. I know that some authors like to put in, they like to add in dialect. Well, I don't prefer that because I don't like reading dialect. So I don't write that way. But that's just, again, that's my reader preference coming through in my writing style. And you find that some authors may want everything exactly as it was, whereas I like to let the story kind of take a flow in a natural, organic sort of way. So I'll know my history well enough to know how the story could go, but it may take a different turn once I start writing it. I have no idea, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's fiction, so, you know, that...
And
that,
it's fiction, you have that
you
license,
have to be,
yeah.
Exactly, yeah. But, yeah, having those, like you were saying before, the nuggets just really, especially somebody like me that's just so geeky about everything.
Well,
like that you don't do dialect because you do get kind of bogged down into it until you get used to it, you know.
Yeah, and I know lots of readers love it. So there's, there's... It's varied. There's lots of readers who love different aspects of different writers' styles, but there's plenty of material out there for everyone. And I find that one of the things that the only piece of history that I came across that I found challenging was the fact that in the 15th century, of course, Scottish nobles or chieftains did not wear kilts. They wore tunics, and they would have worn the nobles would have worn doublet and hose. And I thought, oh great, what have I got myself into now? I got to try to make hose on a man sexy. Oh my gosh! So anyway,
but it was the norm,
I tried.
Then, so yes,
no one has ever come back to me and said this hero isn't sexy. So I tried to dress him in other things, like maybe a leather jerkin at some point or his tunic and stuff. Sometimes he had to wear the doublet and the hose, though, because, of course, he is a noble. And when you're going to the king's court, you must dress accordingly. But that was a bit of fun. I got to say, I did have fun with some of the clothing. But you need to. But I found it difficult. It was a challenge to try to find what the Scottish nobles wore. Because, of course, there was little documentation from the 15th century.
Right.
So the best I could come up with was a document that suggested because the Scottish nobles would have traveled and because of their allegiance with France, that a safe bet would be to suggest that they wore similar clothing to those in France, which would have been the doublet and hose.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with that. Nobody's told me otherwise, so, you know, it's my best guess.
You probably have a lot of people going, where's the kilt?
I know, and I do. And so when people ask me, what do you write? I say, Scottish historical for the most part. Oh, kilts. I'm like, yeah, kilts.
Whatever.
As well to say yes. It takes too long to explain about the doublet and hose.
That's funny. That's funny. Well, see, and that made me start thinking of, like, okay, now I got to go find out how kilts evolved and everything, and I'm going to have to do some research.
Oh,
now.
Yeah. No, it is really interesting. It is really interesting. So during the Jacobite Rebellion, which, of course, is the setting for Outlander, she's got her knot. She can stick them in a kilt. Everybody loves a kilt. It's
all great. Everybody loves that.
Why did I choose? Well, I didn't choose it. It chose me. A period of time that was so much earlier than that.
But that's the foundation for all of that. So, yeah, I can imagine a lot of Outlander fans would want to go find out how it, you know, how it all began, how that all started with James Stewart the First and the whole dynasty from there on. So, yeah, that's fascinating. Well, you've got me intrigued. So,
good.
You got me.
That's
very
good.
Intrigued. And like I said, I'll find myself wandering to Google going, how kilts were came about. So,
it is. It's one of those things. But you can imagine, I mean, I was bogged down on that particular piece because I had to get it right. I mean, I had to dress the man in something. I was bogged down on that for a long time. I have some really interesting reading material that I was able to acquire. But I would say probably 2 months worth of research went into that.
Wow.
And just going through various things, typing different things into Google in different ways to see if something new would come up. And eventually I did come across some writings, very, very old writings, that suggested that it would have been similar to the nobles in France. So there you go. So then I went, okay, well, that I can do because the French wrote everything down. And so I started looking up medieval French dress for nobles, and I came across a fabulous book. And it also included mannerisms, table manners, just different, all kinds of different things. So that was really good. And then I got some other books on just medieval court and stuff like that. So I was able to piece together enough, I think, to make it convincing. But it was a lot of work.
Yeah, right? That's what I said. I think you guys are amazing because it's a lot of work. A contemporary author can just sit down and go, oh, love and mush and fight and happy.
Yeah, I don't know, though, because the contemporary author has to I don't know that I could. I mean, I have dabbled with a little bit of contemporary writing, but I think that unless you're writing it in your own city, you actually have to be very convincing of every detail of that city where you're putting those characters.
Yeah.
That's a lot of research too.
Yeah,
because if I was to write a story set in New York City, somewhere I've never been, how could I possibly do that? Right? I would have to do, I would expect there would be an incredible amount of research in that as well.
Yeah.
So no,
it's
not for me.
You guys are amazing.
I prefer historicals, but that's just me.
Well, we are getting down. We're a little under 5 minutes now, and I want to make sure everybody knows where they can find you online. You have a Facebook author page.
I do, Kate
Robbins.
If you just type in Kate Robbins, not the British singer, the Scottish historical romance author. Actually, she started following me on Twitter. I've got to tell you.
Oh, how funny.
So when I set up my website first, I was trying really, really hard. I was doing a bit of search engine optimization, and I was trying really hard to get my search, value to increase on Google. And eventually I got to I worked at it so hard for almost a year that I eventually got my name to pop up really high. And anyway, then eventually the Kate Robbins, the actual Kate Robbins, started following me on Twitter, and I was like, woohoo! I thought that was kind of cool. She took notice.
Yeah, she's like, who is this person who uses my name?
Exactly. Whoever she
is. Don't worry, I'm not going to sing.
She's coming up in the ranks. I must
That's
follow
awesome.
Her and see what she's up to.
Yeah, really. So you're also on Twitter.
I am, Kate Rob Writer.
Okay. And what is your website?
KateRobbinsAuthor.com.
Author.com, okay.
Yes.
Wrong. Okay, and then I also put the link there to your publisher's website on this page.
Perfect.
So
yes,
and
because
it has
they,
all your
they
links
have everything.
On it.
Yep, they have everything up to date with my Highland Chief series, and of course my Amazon page will show my other publications, which some of which are self-published.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we have more time, we talk about the difference in the two, but we're running low on time.
No problem.
Appreciate you coming on, and good luck with the release of it's Prisoner in the Highland, right?
Prisoner of the Highlander, yes.
Prisoner of the Highlander. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a new fan here. I'm gonna be
thank you. Thank you very much.
See, and that
kilts.
To me is
I mean,
think I've learned more from
you can't be telling everybody that you're looking up kilts without adding on Google.
On Google, right. No, I'll just do the first part. That fits me better anyway.
Perfect.
But yes, you definitely have have me intrigued, beyond intrigued. I'm very excited about that.
Thank you very much. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And good luck with your winter up there. I hope that it gives you many seasons in a day.
Always.
Have a great evening.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening in, guys. This podcast has been recorded and will be available as a podcast from the Authors on the Air website, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And you can find us on authorsontheair.com. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and anywhere else you can think of out there. Thanks for letting me share my passion for romance with you tonight. And I will see you next Thursday at the same time, same place. Right here on The Librarian. Sweet dreams.